You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Welcome, everyone, to our Open Society Fellowship Brown Bag Lunch. And I'm Nancy Chang of our National Security and Human Rights Campaign, which was launched in January of last year to try to take advantage of the opportunities opened up by a new president to push back on a failed global war on terror construct and to shift the paradigm to and promote new human rights responsive policies and in foreign policy and counterterrorism and national security. We're really fortunate today to have Matthew Alexander with us, and the size of the attendance really attests to the interest that his work has generated. Anyway, it is a privilege to introduce Matthew to you, and it's been a privilege for the National Security Human Rights Campaign to have Matthew as a partner as we work toward several important common goals, ensuring that the U.S. permanently and completely renounces the use of torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment in the interrogation of detainees, uncovering the record on the use of torture in the global war on terror so that we can seek accountability for our actions and for violations of rights. And also, where Matthew is especially on point is applying smart and innovative thinking to an issue where, unfortunately, the ticking time bomb scenario and the scaremongering override rational thought. And to see in this effort, the human rights community is starting to join forces with people like Matthew, who work for the military, and other public officials who have actually borne responsibility for keeping America safe, so that they are not simply talking about rights, but about safety. And they are so persuasive for this reason in explaining how America's moral stature as a defender of human rights is essential if we are to promote national security, and how torture, in fact, serves to recruit terrorists. Matthew is a former senior interrogator for the U.S. Air Force, and he has conducted or supervised nearly 1,300 interrogations in Iraq, all in 2006. Matthew has become a leading advocate for non-coercive methods of interrogation and is a relentless critic of the harsh tactics used by the military during the Bush administration, and he has been vocal and covered in the major media and the uniform response to his messaging has been this is exactly the insights that are needed to address this issue, and he is a credible and persuasive speaker. He is the author of How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Use Brains, Not Brutality to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq, and has frequently writes articles for major publications. Matthew is going to speak for about half an hour about his fellowship and some cutting-edge research in which he is engaged, and the remainder of the time will be open to questions and discussion. Matthew.
Yeah, thank you for that introduction. I want to start off by saying thank you
to everybody for
coming, and also thank you to the Open Society Institute for
giving me the opportunity through this fellowship to leverage my experience to try and educate the public and our elected officials, and also to make a difference in the training of interrogators, which is one of the places that not only makes a difference in the human rights field, but also in our ability to stop future terrorist attacks. My background, I was in the Air Force on active duty for a total of 14 years. I started off as a pilot. For the first six, I flew helicopters. I was in Kosovo and Bosnia and during the conflicts there. And then I became a special agent for the Air Force, where I did criminal investigations and I did counterintelligence. Spent most of my time overseas. I did a lot of foreign liaison. And I ran several detachments of agents who did criminal investigations. So I've done quite a few criminal interrogations, and I taught people how to do criminal interrogations for the Air Force. I'm often asked why I decided to speak out, because so few interrogators have come forward and spoken out, and the few that have, most of the stories have been bad news stories about using torture or abuse, either under orders or voluntarily.
And I felt that I had a story that I wanted to tell about what happens when we do things the right way. One of our largest successes in the war on terror, in this conflict, has been the location and locating and killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who is the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And we did that without ever using torture or abuse or violating Geneva Conventions. And so I wanted to tell that story to educate the public about what it means to be an interrogator. It's a profession that I think people should be proud of. It's a profession that can make a real difference. And I'm convinced that most American interrogators would never use torture or abuse if left alone with a detainee without any rules, without any Geneva Conventions, without any oversight. That said, I do think that the record shows that there's been a significant amount of torture and abuse that has occurred since 9/11, and it's more than a few bad apples. And I think that we have an obligation, everybody in the interrogation's career field, to admit those mistakes and to correct them. Where are we with interrogations since President Obama has taken office? What has changed and what has not changed? As everybody knows, the president outlawed torture across all government agencies on his second day in office. And then he put in place a couple of task force, one of which looked at interrogations, with a six-month directive to report back. They came back actually after 8 months. And basically what they came back and said is that the Army Field Manual is fine in its current form for the Army, and law enforcement techniques are fine for law enforcement people who are working in the war on terror, and that they would conduct further research. Now, for 8 years into the war, to say that it now is the time to start further research is a little bit late. We've already had research. We already had a National Science Board Foundation study on interrogation methods, and we already know that law enforcement techniques are extremely effective against al-Qaeda, and that they should already be in the Army Field Manual. So I think the results of the commission, the Presidential Task Force on Interrogation, to me is disappointing. It didn't address some of the underlying issues that led to torture and abuse, such as prejudice against Muslims and Arabs, and how we're going to correct the cultural ignorance that is in some ways still persistent within the U.S. military. And I don't think it brought us in line with Geneva Conventions, with U.S. law, or with international law. The first example I'm going to give you from the Army Field Manual is Appendix M, which is what the Army calls separation, or everybody else knows as solitary confinement. And the Appendix M still allows for detainees to be held in solitary confinement up to 30 days, which can be extended by the first general officer in the chain of command. We all know when you put a permission in a regulation and say that that can be used in exceptions, everybody in the war on terror becomes an exception. It's very easy, I can tell you, from being in the field, it's very difficult to distinguish between captives when you have somebody who's extremely important and somebody who might be mid-level. And the tendency is always to err on the side that this person could be high-level, and therefore to use exceptions or to use that as a means to use enhanced interrogation techniques. I believe that there is a need for some separation after a capture. When I was a police investigator, we separate criminal suspects when we capture them in a crime, when we arrest them, so that they can't share information. But how long should that go on? The standard that I would apply is the standard that I always used for interrogations, which is the golden rule. How would I feel about this if it was applied to one of my own troops who was captured? Take my youngest 18, 19-year-old Army one striper and put them in enemy hands. How long would I be comfortable with their solitary confinement before I'd consider it to be abuse, inhumane treatment, or torture? And I think for me, the limit is at 30 days, is how long I would feel comfortable. Although I would say that's probably a stretch for some people. I do think that there's a justified reason to separate people after they've been captured, but I don't think that more than 30 days could be considered anything other than abuse. And there is still I believe, and I know it's still occurring, is extended solitary confinement for some detainees. My other concern has to do with two of the approaches that are in the Army Field Manual. One is called Fear Up Harsh, in which you instill fear in a detainee, and the other is called Pride and Ego Down, in which you would lower somebody's self-esteem or their pride or their ego. Now, the Field Manual warns that both of these can be used in a manner which would violate Geneva Conventions. Fear Up Harsh could be used in a manner in which threats are issued to a detainee against their physical well-being or their family, and it states that that's illegal. But it also says that you can use the fear, unknown fears of a person, and manipulate those to convince them to cooperate. It's a little bit, watching this method in practice and expecting young soldiers to distinguish the difference between these things, it's very nuanced. And it's very difficult, I can tell you, for young interrogators to know the difference between an indirect threat and a direct threat and not to make either. The Army lawyers will tell you that you can't put what they call the dagger on the table. In other words, you can't directly threaten a detainee. However, they've decided that it's permissible to make an indirect threat if the detainee forms that threat in their mind. Well, when I was a criminal investigator, the difference between an indirect threat and a threat was the same in terms of criminal punishment. And so I think that Fear Up Harsh is still consistently misused by Army interrogators, and I think it's probably the most problematic approach that leads to abuses. Pride and Ego Down, in the same way, there's a prohibition against using it in a way in which it would humiliate a detainee, but it's extremely difficult to use Pride and Ego Down and not humiliate somebody by lowering their ego or assaulting their abilities. The other thing that's been taken out of the new Army Field Manual versus the last version previous is the use of stress positions. There's no longer a prohibition against stress positions. And although DOD has said that they're not going to use stress positions because they don't consider it humane, there is no prohibition against using them. Sleep deprivation is still permissible. The regulation now says that detainees must be given 4 hours of sleep in a 24-hour period. But as I saw this manipulated by some interrogators, who wanted to give a detainee 4 hours of sleep and then interrogate them for 20 hours and then start a new 24-hour period and interrogate for 20 more hours and then give them 4 hours of sleep. And the problem with that is now you've got people manipulating the rule, which was intended to give somebody 4 hours of sleep in every 24 hours. I don't think that anybody would argue that if you went 7 years of confinement with 4 hours of sleep a night, that that wouldn't be abuse. And certainly wouldn't meet the requirement for humane treatment under Geneva Conventions. And yet it's still legally allowable. I think the argument, let me talk about one more issue, which is the reporting of capture. Recently, Department of Defense has come out and said they will report all captures within 14 days. The problem with this is that
Geneva Conventions doesn't say 14 days.
Geneva Conventions says immediately.
And you can imagine that if it was your son or daughter
that was captured by the enemy, if you didn't know
their whereabouts,
or if they were alive or dead for 14 days, certainly I think you would consider that not in accordance with the intention of Geneva Conventions.
It doesn't take more than a couple hours to torture or abuse somebody. And that's the reason the Geneva Conventions was written to say immediately,
to prevent that,
and to also so that notifications could be made to family members when somebody is captured. So I think 14 days is too long. I don't think we should wait 14 days. I think we should do it as soon as we capture somebody, and I think that would be another safeguard against torture and abuse. I think the argument, to some degree, has shifted from what's lawful to what's better than what was happening. And that, to me, is very concerning. I would like to see the shift go back to where we were prior to 9/11, which was the enforcement of the law. And I think one of the big reasons we won't see that in the near future is because of the lack of accountability. People do things
And the incentives are there to do things much stronger when there is no accountability for not being in line with the law. I spent my whole career in the military, and I think one of the most disappointing things about the entire policy of torture and abuse was the failure of leadership. As a military officer, I was trained to lead people, to set the example. Every year, every person in the military goes through law of armed conflict training in which we talk about torture and abuse. We talk about the need to stand up. We talk about the leadership aspect of following the law of armed conflict. And in every version of the Army Field Manual since 1949, there's been references to Geneva Conventions, Common Article 3, and UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and the negative consequences of using torture and abuse against enemy prisoners of war, whether lawful or unlawful. And yet, I think the most disappointing thing that has come out of this is the failure of military leadership to stand up and say that torture and abuse is inconsistent with military values or with American values. My research really is two parts in my fellowship. The first part is advocacy. It's educating the public. I do a lot of public speaking at universities. I go to private schools, grades 9 through 12. And I try to erase a lot of the misperceptions about interrogations. I often ask people, audiences, what's the first thing that comes to mind when I say the word interrogation? And as you can imagine, the first word is torture. I would like to change that perception. Interrogators are a professional career field. It's an art and a science. It can be improved. And it can be, as I'm going to show you from my research, a force multiplier, and it can actually advance human rights. So advocacy and educating the public and interrogators, I go to every graduation of Army and Guard and Reserve interrogators to speak. I'm going this week, and one of the things that I provide them is an unofficial interrogation manual that I've been working on. And in that manual, there's two major issues I'm trying to address. The first is the lack of law enforcement techniques in the Army Field Manual. There's a ton of law enforcement techniques that you can watch every night on Law and Order or CSI or whichever one is your favorite show that Army interrogators are not familiar with but are extremely applicable to this conflict and to Al-Qaeda. Why? Because Al-Qaeda is not organized like rank-and-file soldiers. They're organized like a criminal gang or like a narcotics gang. And so law enforcement techniques, not only are they relevant, they're more relevant and more applicable than the traditional Army interrogation methods. Not that the Army interrogation methods don't work, they do. But there's other ones that can complement them that aren't being used. And so those are in the unofficial interrogation manual, and the other part of the interrogation manual are positive aspects of Muslim and Arab culture that an interrogator can use to their advantage. And let me give you an example of that. Well, let me say this first. I'm the only interrogator I've ever met that's ever read the Quran. That should shock us. If the people that we're interrogating are supposedly such diehard jihadists who have memorized the Quran and use that as the basis for their actions, we should have at least opened that book and be familiar with it. But the Army's training on culture consists of PowerPoint slides typically taught by U.S. Army interrogators, not by cultural specialists. There are some now, I believe, at Fort Huachuca, at the active duty reserve course. Some courses are being taught by cultural specialists, usually, I think, former interpreters, which is an improvement, but it's not where we should be. But part of my manual, my intention is to erase the prejudice that's existent within the military interrogator corps against Muslims and against Arabs. And one of the, just to give you an example, one of the things I talk about is, in my experience, I found, and from reading the Quran, that a big part of Arab and Muslim culture is the concept of mercy towards enemies. And throughout Arab history, there's several Arab leaders, Salah al-Din is a good example during the Crusades, who were famous for showing mercy towards their enemies. And that's just one cultural concept that can be used by an interrogator to convince somebody to cooperate by showing them mercy and showing them that you appreciate their culture. And that's what I'm trying to put into this unofficial interrogation manual. I recently went on a trip to Indonesia, and I went there specifically to speak to a guy by the name of Tito Karnavian. And Colonel Karnavian, who just got promoted to Brigadier General, is in charge of intelligence, and now he actually just became the commander of Indonesia's Detachment 88, which is their elite counterterrorism unit. Detachment 88 was established after the first Bali bombing in 2002. It was funded, trained, and equipped by the U.S. and the Australians. And their mission is counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. And Tito Karnavian has run the interrogators for Detachment 88. And he's been at the head of all the interrogations of captured insurgents, most of whom belong to Jamaah Islamiyah, if you're familiar with terrorist groups in Indonesia. And his interrogation methods are somewhat revolutionary. And I found it quite fascinating, the methods that he's using, and the fact that Indonesia's Detachment 88 interrogators, who we trained and equipped, are using methods that we have yet to adopt. What are his methods and why are they so unique? Colonel Karnavian has basically taken interrogation and turned it into de-radicalization and rehabilitation. If you consider the types of methods he uses, it starts with relationship building and a very in-depth analysis. He provided me his background paper on how he came up with these methods, but basically, they diagnose the people that they interrogate according to categories, such as whether somebody's spiritual, a spiritual supporter, if they're involved emotionally, materially, whether they're hardcore operative, a supporter, a sympathizer. And then they go on to look at that person personally and analyze their motives to see what is their dominant motive for having joined, what is their role in the network, and what are their personal problems. For those of you that are familiar with my book, this is something I went into in depth, is the fact that I never met anybody in Iraq who had joined Al-Qaeda because they believed in the ideology. I met a lot of people who joined for a lot of personal reasons, whether it was defending their families from militias, whether it was for money, whether it was because of social connections to their tribe or their family, or whether it was because they were concerned about Sunni access to oil wealth and the future of Iraq. I didn't meet anybody who joined because of ideology. And Colonel Karnavian's experiences are similar in Indonesia. And so he tries to find out what are those very personal problems that cause somebody to join, and then he addresses those. And this is where his methods differ from what we're doing in the U.S. because Colonel Karnavian can apply real incentives. They will take a capture, and they will offer them, if they cooperate, they will offer to pay their family and support them financially for the entire duration of their confinement. For single detainees, they've gotten them wives. For married detainees, they've brought their wives in and secured hotel rooms. they've had great success in applying incentives that address the very personal issues of why somebody joins a terrorist network. And the other thing that I think advantage they have is that they appreciate the culture of the detainees. They pray with them, they provide them halal food, and they never criticize their religious beliefs. One of the people that Colonel Karnavian brought to the interview was Nasser Abbas. And Nasser Abbas and I talked. Nasser Abbas used to be the number three guy in Jamaah Islamiyah. He was the one who set up terrorist training camps in the Philippines, and he was in charge of basically one of three regions for JI. And Nasser Abbas was captured and interrogated and turned very quickly to becoming an advocate against violent jihad and working for the police. And he now works for the police in Indonesia. He wrote a best-selling book about his experiences in JI, and he's now one of their best sources for investigating terrorists and for interrogating. He acts as an advisor. And I just want to read you a couple statements from Nasser Abbas about why, I asked him why he decided to cooperate with the police. Why go from being a very prominent person in JI to within a few days
becoming one of the police's best sources of information. He said, "My mission to uphold the Jamiat Islamiya Islamic State rather than carrying out the mission of Osama bin Laden to retaliate by killing American civilians and their allies was right. I was one of the organizational and leadership Jamiat Islamiya members. I love Jamiat Islamiya and all its members. I agreed to stop these bombings because I think the action was not a practice of Islamic struggle and even troubling other JI members. My interrogator, Mr. Bektu, believes I am a leader rather than an ordinary member of JI. This attitude means he trusts me. It means he really expects me to help the police stop the bombings. Trust must be repaid by trust. It is a fair attitude. I do not need to be content with his heart, but he has proved his sincerity to understand what is happening." They've never convinced Nasser Abbas not to support the views of establishing an Islamic state in Indonesia. What they have done is convinced him to be an advocate against violence and furthering that. I think we can look at what's happening in Indonesia and apply that to our own interrogators and improve the process. The question is, would this work in Afghanistan? What incentives would you use to convince members of the Taliban to defect? In Iraq, with the Anbar Awakening, which basically skipped the entire interrogation rehabilitation process, when we went to some influential Sunni sheikhs and began to pay them for them to turn against al-Qaeda, the incentive was quite clear. Arms and money and access to future oil wealth through American assistance, I believe, in exchange for fighting al-Qaeda. Would that same incentive work in Afghanistan for the Taliban? Or would the incentive have to include some type of autonomous regional zone under Taliban control that would be ruled by Sharia law? I think these are questions we have to ask. In Iraq, the incentives worked, but Sunni Iraqis never believed in a Sharia state. I think the other problem with trying to use incentives in Afghanistan or challenge is what's been called valleyization, which is that the incentive might be something in one province or in one town, but just a few miles away, the incentive might be completely different. Where in Iraq, the Sunni tribes were mostly united in what they were trying to accomplish, which was protection from Shia militias and access to future oil wealth. One of the things that I've become kind of enamored with recently is what I'm calling the counterinsurgency leadership re-revolution. And I call it the re-revolution because actually we learned these lessons in the 50s and 60s prior to Vietnam, but we failed to apply them entirely in Vietnam. And it seems like only recently that we've started to go back and look at it. Has anybody in here ever read the book The Ugly American? It came out in the 50s by Eugene Burdick and William Lederer. It's an interesting look at what happens when people in the field understand cultures and effectively work with them to counter, at that time, what was a communist insurgencies, and how those efforts can be completely annihilated, I guess is the best word, by diplomats who are ignorant of culture. There's several advocates recently that I think have become a pool of experts on American counterinsurgency theory. And what's interesting is probably the main and leading voice is not an American, he's an Australian, and that's David Kilcullen. If you're familiar with Kilcullen, he wrote something called 28 Articles, which described his lessons from his time spent in the Australian Army in Indonesia conducting counterinsurgency. And Kilcullen also wrote a book called The Accidental Guerrilla. And most of Kilcullen's work, if you go back and look at General McChrystal's quotes when he was advocating in the media for an additional 40,000 troops in Afghanistan, almost everything he said is a direct Kilcullen quote taken from his articles and his beliefs. And the other person I think is strongly influencing the way we're doing counterinsurgency now is John Nagel, who wrote a book called Learning to Eat Soup with a Spoon. And John Nagel was an army colonel and commander in Iraq in Anbar province in 2004. And these two men have directly influenced, I think along with General Petraeus, the way Americans have come to view now counterinsurgency doctrine and the way that we fight. In fact, Kilcullen's 28 articles was included in the Army's counterinsurgency manual.
As far as Afghanistan and General McChrystal, I think he's saying the right things, but I'm still looking for the proof. I think there's been some positive developments with detention policy. I know that they have engaged in discussions with the human rights community about detention issues, but I don't think everything has been implemented. And I think a recent New York Times article and Washington Post article just came out 2 weeks ago pointed to some of the concerns that everybody still has about detention practices. Where do we go from here? What are my recommendations for how we can improve the way we interrogate? The first thing I would say is we do need a new Army field manual. The Army is a bureaucracy, and they're stubborn. And they just rewrote the manual in 2006, and I think they don't want to rewrite it. I think very senior interrogators have stated that they believe the manual's fine and that it works and that the techniques in it are all they need. And they're not, I think, amenable to rewriting it and including law enforcement techniques. And I think it's really just a matter of stubbornness. And there's also some protection of turf going on in there, because there's always a little bit of a rivalry between law enforcement agencies like FBI and the DOD. I think we need to improve the training of interrogators. American interrogators, I almost look at them as like the perfect raw material. Because of our background, because of the fact that we live in a very diverse society with a multitude of religions and ethnicities, I think that American interrogators are particularly well suited, if trained correctly, to become very proficient as interrogators. They're smart, they're enthusiastic, they're eager to learn. And I think my experience in Iraq proves to me that even those that held some prejudice under the right leadership will abandon that very quickly when exposed to the correct attitudes towards detainees in this war. I think we need an independent inquiry into the policy of torture and abuse, and I think for me as a military professional that it's especially important for the military because it's a leadership issue. And when you multiply that out over all the different professions, this isn't just about interrogations. It's about military leadership and how it interprets the law of armed conflict and how it will abide by that, and that affects every profession in the military. And I think without that independent inquiry, we won't have accountability, which I think will be the most likely indicator that we will torture and abuse prisoners again. I think we can adopt best practices such as those that are being used in Indonesia. I think if we took a view of interrogations that it doesn't exist in a vacuum. The Army's view of interrogations is that it exists solely to extract intelligence information that will allow us to go out and conduct missions. I think if we viewed it much more holistically as part of the entire counterinsurgency campaign, then we would be more likely to implement what's happening in Indonesia, and we would turn a tactical weapon into a strategic one. Interrogations has always been thought of as a tactical weapon. You're going to get information, you go out and execute a target. But it's never been thought of as a strategic weapon that can convert somebody to be an advocate against violence who would later help to dissuade future people from joining a terrorist organization. And that's strategic leverage. With that, I'll open it up to questions. Amber.
Matthew, thank you so much for just an insightful discussion with lots of important new ideas and bringing them to the fore. We're going to have a round of Q&A, and everyone should speak into the microphone. I'll start with Amrit.
Sorry. My question was, are you afraid, how would you respond to the claim that we continuously encounter in the context of trying to get information on interrogation methods, that if these interrogation methods are actually disclosed, then this would allow terrorists to essentially reverse engineer and figure out their counter strategy to attempts to try and get information? And in that context, I found your suggestion, for example, of trying to circulate the an interrogation, details of an interrogation method that actually exploited the concept of mercy, for example. Suppose that were to become publicly available and it was part of the Army Field Manual, do you think that that would actually be counterproductive? And relatedly, do you think that, I'm just wondering whether the mercy, your interrogation method relating to the use of mercy could actually is actually consistent with the broad categories of interrogation methods that are already set out in the Army Field Manual, so that what you're really talking about is not the sort of the coarse descriptions of the interrogation methods, but the interrogation plans that are more detailed about how to approach a detainee, how to use rapport, and so on and so forth.
The first part of that is the analogy I always make when I'm faced with this question is Al Qaeda knows what an M16 looks like, it knows how it works, but it can't stop bullets. In interrogation, the same way. Our methods are tools; they're the weapon. But how we use them can't be countered just by knowing that they exist. And the perfect example is law enforcement. You can turn on Law and Order, or CSI, or any other program any night and watch real law enforcement techniques being used, because all those shows have former law enforcement as advisors who are helping to write those scripts. And yet every day police and detectives in the United States go out and do their jobs and get people to confess to crimes. It's not the method that's important, it's the way in which it's used and used correctly. So the example I love comes from Colonel Kleinman, Steve Kleinman, who was an interrogator, one of our most experienced interrogators. And he also happens to be the Siri instructor who refused to teach interrogators in Iraq how to use Siri techniques. And Colonel Kleinman basically used to say that people can know what the method is, but how you apply it is what's going to make the difference. And on that end, I guess the best example I can give you is a police investigative technique and an experience that I had in Iraq. We went into a house one night. I was doing interrogations at the point of capture, so I was attached to an Army team that would go out and raid houses and capture people. And we came into the house, and there was two twin brothers. And we were looking, we knew that these two twin brothers were part of an Al-Qaeda cell, and we were looking for the person they worked for who happened to be a weapons dealer. And when we captured them, we separated them into two separate rooms. My interrogation partner and I, he took one person to interrogate, and I took the other. And we told each one that the other one had already confessed and told us where their leader was. Now, one of these guys knew this technique. He said, "I've seen this. I know what you're doing." But that doesn't mean he doesn't know whether his brother still gave us that information and whether it was true or not. He knows the technique, but there's nothing he can do to defend against it. It's how we use the techniques and how proficient we are at using them. And, you know, it's the Army's decision to make the field manual unclassified, not mine. To address the second part of that question, which is, so we have the methods, but how we use the methods, should that be classified or should that be out in the open? This book right here, The Interrogator, thank you, David, for the lens, is the story of Hans Scharf, who was an interrogator in World War II for the Germans. And he was extremely effective in interrogating downed American pilots in the war. In fact, his interrogation success rate, you could say, was probably up around 80 or 90%. And he did that using relationship-building approaches, and he spells out exactly how he used them in this book. And I could give you 10 other books in which people talk about interrogation methods and concrete examples of how they used them. The problem is there's a misperception that Al-Qaeda is highly trained on interrogation methods and resistance training, and that they can counter our techniques. They can't. And detainee needs information as much as we do. When they walk into that interrogation booth, they need to know how long they're going to be in captivity. They want to know what's going to be the outcome. They want to know if they're still going to be able to participate in this conflict or further their cause. And those needs aren't going to go away simply because they know what technique we're using or what our techniques are. Because interrogation is ultimately a negotiation, and both sides want something in that negotiation. And it's the skill of the interrogator that makes that happen, regardless of whether or not they know what technique we're using.
Tom?
Tom Kellogg, I run the China program here at OSI. I'm just curious what the reaction within the armed forces has been to the advocacy that you've done and the writing that you've done over the past year or so. One, in terms of the actual sort of substance of the recommendations that you are putting forward, and two, whether or not they have, sort of felt like this isn't something that someone from their own ranks should be putting forward, whether you felt any sort of pressure or sort of bad feeling because you're coming out of that community and saying these things.
The reaction's been mixed. On a personal level, people will approach me and say, thank you for speaking out. Thank you for bringing these issues. There might be some criticism about going public with it versus taking it privately. But for the most part, I would say like 90% of the responses I've gotten have been positive, especially from interrogators. The criticism has been at me for criticizing the U.S. Army and interrogation methods. Or the unwillingness to change or adopt law enforcement techniques. And the response that I've received basically is, to some degree, been alienation. And the rest I can't comment on. But there has been a mixed reaction. I expected that. Change doesn't come easy. And if you know the story in my book, I talk about how when I was in Iraq, even when we were using the methods and they were extremely effective, there was still resistance to them, even after they'd proven their worth. Time and time again, there was people who still believed in the use of enhanced interrogation techniques, which I consider to be torture, a minimum abuse, and believed that we should always have that option. And there were some people who believed we should start there. So I do think there's been a mixed reaction within the government. Now, in the same respect, it's Army interrogators that invite me, who are now instructors, who invite me every class to go and speak to the Guard and Reserve interrogators that are graduating. So there are instructors in the Army interrogators who have definitely been very supportive.
Sandy?
Hi, Sandy Colliver with the Open Society Justice Initiative. I'll have to be careful not to use JI as an acronym anymore. So a few questions following up on Tom's point. I, too, was interested in the reaction. And are you now completely out of the career of the Air Force? Do you plan to go back in? Are there people who are actually coming and saying that they too want to go public? And that's, I'm particularly interested in that because I know that it took time for officers in Iraq finally to come forward and to start speaking, and that kind of community of speaking with others helps. Second question, who are the interrogators? You mentioned the men of energy and intelligence and goodwill in Iraq. We, of course, hear that a lot of the interrogators are brought in by the private companies. I've also heard, for instance, that interrogators are pretty much everywhere with every battalion, and that it's not just Abu Ghraib, et cetera. So I wondered, is there a sense as to how many interrogators there are in a field of battle in Iraq? What are the different at parts of Department of Defense, intelligence, et cetera, how many different units have them? My third question, just you mentioned accountability, and you said that that's important. And I wonder how far up the chain you think that needs to go, and do you think it would go up to Rumsfeld? And maybe, could I just pass it, Darian, do you want to follow with?
Well, that's maybe a plenty.
Okay.
Okay.
I
have a question.
Let's see, the first part of that was, are other interrogators coming forth? And the answer is no. There's a very strong disincentive to come forth and criticize the United States military from within. And I think we're going to have another forum in the next year about dissent. Dissent in the military has never been well looked upon. I come from the Air Force. The Air Force was started by a dissenter, Colonel Billy Mitchell, who was court-martialed for his dissent. And it doesn't look well upon people who break ranks, especially with public criticism. And I think that it's very much discouraged people from coming forward. And also, there's all types of other issues that can be brought to light when you do dissent. And one of those has to do with the ways that the military can retaliate against you. And those provide very strong incentives to not come out publicly and speak. Let's see, there was a second question.
Are you still career?
Oh, so I'm still in the reserves. And I still plan to stay in the reserves. I have 17 total years, so I have 3 more to go. And I would go back to being an interrogator in a heartbeat if there was an opportunity, but I don't suspect that after my public criticism that they're so inclined to take me back. In fact, you know, I asked several times to participate or to give a voice in the presidential task force, and myself and several other interrogators who have been public critics were all told that that they would not speak to us. Oh, okay, so this is a great question. Who are the interrogators? Within the Army, about 80% of the interrogators fall between the ages of about 19 and 23, 24. The way the Army develops an interrogator is they come in as enlisted. They take an academic test, an aptitude test, with the standards of which were just lowered quite significantly because they have a real recruiting problem with getting more interrogators, people in the interrogation field. The reason it was high to start with was because most interrogators have to go to language training, and so they need the aptitude to be able to pass the language training. Although I would obviously make the argument that they need the aptitude also to be an interrogator, but not just the language training. They're mostly very young people, and you know, of that 90% of interrogators, probably 80% have never even been outside the U.S., I would guess. Probably 80% have never even met a Muslim or an Arab. That doesn't mean necessarily that these are bad people. It means that they're young, they don't have life experiences, and in many ways they can be ignorant, not by choice, but by age. And most of them are willing to learn. If given the right leadership and right opportunities, they will do so and they will excel. There is another component of interrogators, and that's contractors. There are private contracting firms, and they hire people typically who are retired military interrogators or intelligence officers or from other government agencies, for instance, the Secret Service and such. And so they will go through an interrogation course. There's a course called the Phoenix course that they can go through to become qualified, and also they can go through a shortened version of the Army interrogator course that I went through. And my experience was, I can't tell you that those people who were most likely to use enhanced interrogation techniques or wanted to bend and break the rules came from any one group. I can tell you there's a direct link between prejudice and wanting to use those techniques. The same people who were reading and passing around the politically incorrect guide to Islam and using terms like raghead or other derogatory terms towards detainees were the ones that consistently wanted to use harsh techniques. And so that's who the interrogator corps is.
And accountability.
What I say about accountability and how high it should go is that we're a nation of laws. We believe in the law, and the law applies to everyone. I think we've had a strong indicator of that. I think one of the most interesting things to do on that issue is to go back and look at the statements that were made by elected officials during Clinton's impeachment. And if you look at the people who at that time were the strongest advocates for enforcement for the rule of law, they have now become the strongest advocates for not upholding the law. You know, as a military member, I think that the Uniform Code of Military Justice should apply here. It's a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice to assault somebody, anybody. In fact, war crimes are addressed in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And so, you know, when I was a criminal investigator, it would be an assault to lay your finger on somebody. So I don't know how we can say that stress positions, slapping, slamming into a wall, waterboarding, could not be considered assault. under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And the people who gave the orders and authorized those things would be just as accountable as the people who enacted them. So I don't think it should stop anywhere. I think we should just enforce the law.
Do we have any questions in D.C.?
Hi, Nancy, can you hear me?
Hi, Seema.
Hi. I was very interested in what you said about changing perception of Muslims and Arabs. And I was wondering, aside from what you've done to sort of take that on within the military, what you think we as a human rights community and civil liberties advocate sort of lack in that realm with respect to sort of public outreach and changing American perceptions, and what we can do better, especially in light of, let's say, something like Fort Hood or just the post 9/11 era in general.
I'm convinced that you address this issue through exposure. I mean, education's great. You know, the Army trains interrogators and gives them PowerPoint briefings, which we love. We can't learn anything without a PowerPoint briefing in the military. But they can educate people, and they give them facts. They can say, you know, here's the year Muhammad was born. Here's the difference between Sunni and Shia. But until they actually get exposed to that culture and get to know people in that culture, I think it's very hard to overcome that aspect of prejudice. It's almost like you want to make everybody go out and watch the movie American History X to understand how you come to how you overcome prejudice. And that's extremely difficult. I think the best thing we could do for public advocacy is to get Arabs and Muslims to tell us this, or to share with us the positive aspects of their culture. It's why I think we should have Muslim and Arab instructors for our military interrogators, and not Army military members teaching those subjects. I know for the Air Force, when I went through training, our instructors were Iraqis who were now U.S. citizens, but who had grown up in Iraq. And it made a huge world of difference to be able to interact with them versus just reading a PowerPoint slide. As far as advocacy, I think the best thing we can do is get members of that community to talk about the positive aspects of their culture. And I think we also, I always tune in to the words that are used when people are talking about Al-Qaeda in terms like the worst of the worst, hardcore, calling torture and abuse harsh techniques. I think there's been a lot of lingo that's been extremely counterproductive in setting the example or the atmosphere in which Army interrogators would know that it's not productive and not acceptable to use torture and abuse. The example I typically give is the last commander that I worked for in Iraq. He came in, and his first day he gathered everybody in a conference room, and he said, "I came here to Iraq with two things, and I'm leaving with both, my father's last name and my integrity." And there was no question in anybody's mind from day one that torture and abuse wouldn't be tolerated. And I think that's the type of leadership example that we have to set.
I think we have time for one more question.
I was wondering, what's your take on the debate on whether torture works or enhanced interrogation techniques? Is it useful to have it? Is it possible not to have it, to avoid it? And how does one have an intelligent debate on that while a lot of the information that our former vice president refers to is still classified?
To start with, I'd say the debate shouldn't be about what's effective. Flamethrowers are effective. Chemical weapons are effective. That doesn't mean they're moral, and we don't use them. When an Army infantry unit, during the ground war in Iraq, they tried to go through the Karbala Pass and they met resistance, they didn't go, "Well, you know what? We could save lives by using chemical weapons. Let's just drop those," because they're effective and they save lives. We never make that argument for any other profession other than interrogations. So I think the former administration officials, including Vice President Cheney, they've tried to shift this argument to what's effective so that we wouldn't be talking about what's lawful. Nobody, I think anybody who's an interrogator would tell you that torture would never work. Any technique will work on somebody. I can walk in every day and hand somebody a piece of candy, and I guarantee there's somebody in the world for whom that would convince them to cooperate. Every technique can work. The question is, what are the short and long-term effects of that? If you use torture and you get information from somebody, I mean, we all know the argument about what the validity or the reliability of that information if it's gotten under coercion. But I'm always going to go back to, what are the long-term consequences of using torture? We know that it recruits for the enemy, as I heard in Iraq time and time again from captured foreign fighters who said that the reason they joined al-Qaeda was because of torture and abuse at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. We know that it will lead to worse conditions for U.S. soldiers when captured in the future. We know it'll make future enemies less willing to surrender to us, which will have a cost in human lives. And for me as an interrogator, most importantly, it makes future detainees less willing to cooperate, which means we have a significant disadvantage in trying to get information that would stop terrorist attacks. And that's because they walk in the interrogation room and immediately they see us as a torturer and not somebody that they can trust and confide in. So there's all these long-term negative consequences of torture. But what I would say also is, I'll take this challenge any day. Give somebody a waterboard and a bucket, a board, a bucket, and water, and give me my techniques with the same detainee, and I guarantee I'll get the information quicker. It does not take long to develop a relationship with a detainee. I could walk into the interrogation booth with a Quran, recite a verse, show good treatment and respect to my detainee, and build a relationship in 10 minutes. I guarantee you can't waterboard somebody and get information in 10 minutes. And I could start to get information that quickly. In the field, in the case of using law enforcement techniques that I described with the twin brothers, I can get information in 2 minutes by using deception. You can't do that with torture. And the other bad thing about torture and its effectiveness is that when you use torture, you're shooting for the bare minimum. Because what somebody's going to give you is the bare minimum amount of information that's going to make that pain or suffering go away. As an interrogator, my mission is not to go out and get the minimum amount of information. No commander ever came to me and said, go out and get the minimum. My intention is to get the maximum amount of information. You get that through cooperation, not through coercion. And as Colonel Kleinman said, I love this quote, if you use coercion, you can get somebody to tell you the location of a house. But if you use cooperation, they'll tell you if the house is booby-trapped. It's a very important distinction.
Well, Matthew, we can't thank you enough. You've brought so much wisdom to a very difficult subject, and we thank you for elevating the public discussion on this issue, and we're looking forward to hearing more about your fellowship and the research that you'll be conducting. So thank you.
Thank you.